thinking big thoughts, so you don't have to.
Here's a question.
Here's John Williams.
Here's me. It's what we do. It's a talk show. We ask questions. Sometimes we say things and answer questions, but I got a question to start the show as we broadcast all the way until 3 o'clock. We're 18 stories above the Chicago River, overlooking beautiful downtown Chicago and the Tricolor Lake. There's three hues on Lake Michigan by the shore today. Positively lovely today. Kind of choppy out there, too. Hope you had a nice night. And I feel like it's kind of the weekend already because we were over at the Pritzker Pavilion last night as Jazz Fest gets underway in Chicago. And we just had a terrific time over there. And I hope the weather cooperates and you get a chance to take in some of it, too. But here's my question for you. Kim, have you thought about, I'll ask this to any of y'all, but do you ever think, when I die someday, who you want to speak at your funeral or memorial service? Have you ever thought about that?
I mean, the only thing that pops into my head is one of my children.
Yeah. Well, and so that's what I thought. If I pass away, I'll leave it up to Brenda, Grant, or Griff to answer that question for themselves. If they don't want to talk or if they're too emotional, you know, if for some reason they don't want to talk, that's okay. But of course, it would be appropriate to me that they do. But then I think, okay, outside my immediate family, who else? And so depending on the mood I'm in or how close I am to certain people at certain times, I thought, oh, I would love it if this person spoke, or I would, I guess that's it. I would like some of these people to sort of speak about me or our relationship or honor me, or I want to honor them by getting to speak at my thing. I don't know. I think about that sometimes. But one thing I've never thought about is would I invite or not invite somebody to my funeral? I'm thinking a little bit about John McCain because there's a story today that we all know that the president isn't invited, but Sarah Palin is not invited to John McCain's memorial services either.
Maybe it's just because it would be so uncomfortable for the family. Not because maybe John McCain is sending a message, but also maybe because it would just be uncomfortable for survivors.
That's an interesting point, right? So maybe he's not bitter about Sarah. I think we can read the room pretty well on his relationship with Donald Trump. But in the case of Sarah Palin, maybe that's just being nice to everybody else. It's not about John McCain. It's about how awkward it would be in that
right.
room. Now, that's a generous view. Maybe that's it. Maybe that's it. Alaska Governor Sarah Palin, CNN says, is not invited to any of the memorial services for her former running mate. She said, you know, it's kind of a gut punch when after the election was over, he said that he wished instead of Sarah Palin being his running mate, it was Joe Lieberman, his friend. He wanted to run with Joe. His people said, no, that won't work. Go with Sarah. He goes with Sarah Palin. There was a lot of energy in the campaign for a while, and then the whole thing fell apart. So on Friday, McCain's going to Lyon State at the U.S. Capitol for a ceremony before public visitation Friday evening. So if Sarah Palin really wanted to publicly pay her respects, and it's probably best she doesn't, but if she wanted to, she could go to maybe the public viewing. Saturday, there's a funeral service that'll be held at the National Cathedral in Washington. Palin has not been invited to attend, although the men who defeated McCain in his presidential campaigns, Obama and George Bush, will speak at the service. Not only are they invited, they're going to speak. That's odd, isn't it? Here's her running mate, or his running mate. She's not invited, and the guys that beat him are.
Well, you know, that's the beauty of McCain. Like, he put it out there, and you knew how he stood and how he felt about things. And I think he forged a respect and friendship for the two people that beat him.
Yeah, you know, evidently.
Maybe there's not the respect and friendship
for Sarah Palin. Final ceremony for McCain will take place Sunday afternoon at the U.S. Naval Academy in Annapolis. He'll be buried at the Naval Academy next to his longtime friend and classmate, Admiral Chuck Larson. So Sarah Palin is not invited. And yeah, maybe that's not a message about Sarah as much as it is the room. I've never thought about who I would or wouldn't invite, but I don't have any, you know, I never ran for president. Nothing in my life has been so elevated that I'm going to carry around something for the rest of my life. I guess you don't have to run for president for people to hold grudges or have lifelong friendships or whatever the opposite of a friendship is, but I can't think of any, you know, like the people I don't like or have not gotten along with my whole life, they wouldn't attend anyway. There would be no reason for them to. And I don't think I would not invite somebody anyway. But maybe that's a common thing. I thought, yeah, you invite people to a funeral service, I guess. You know, it seems to me like when people I know have passed away, you find out where the memorial service is and then you attend. You don't necessarily get invited, right? You just go. In this case, I guess limited space and you're a famous person. So I'm wondering how this works, but you must need to get invited. And then you have to make out a list. Have you ever done a wedding? And some people get invited and some people don't. And so if you had only so many spots available, then yeah, maybe Sarah's not a logical spot taker. Steve, are you listening to any of this? I know you just
traded
seats with Kim, and right. I see that Sarah's not invited to John McCain's memorial service. Kim speculated that maybe that's just the magnanimous way for the McCains to handle it. Don't make it awkward for anybody.
By not inviting her?
Right.
Well, that would makes it awkward for her, doesn't it?
Yeah, but suppose they said, okay, right, she was your running mate, she'll come. But knowing that, in fact, he didn't even want her to
be his
running
mate. Well, if that's the case, right.
Then maybe it's just best we don't even go there, particularly considering how things blew up with him and Donald Trump. Let's just leave those guys out.
And I don't think that there should be a quote-unquote entitlement to an invitation. And just because you worked with someone, you know, in a high-profile job doesn't mean you're entitled to go to a high-profile event.
Yeah. But do people do that? Do they specifically not invite people funerals?
I've had you on and off my list several times.
I was, you know, again, you guys were trading seats over there, but I said at the start of this little conversation that I've thought in the past, when I die, who do I want to speak? Mm-hmm. You know, like I was when I worked with Matt Bubala all the time, I thought, boy, if I died tomorrow, I think Matt would be a very good spokesperson for me. My friend Clay Jenkinson, you know, outside of my immediate family, I think, okay, people I've worked with and been very close to would be great people to eulogize.
I would be much nicer to you than Matt, just for the record. You know that's true.
Absolutely it is. Of course, Matt knows me a little better, too, maybe. I mean, worked with me so
closely. Yeah, but Steve already has that serious, sad look.
Really?
Wow. It comes prepackaged, so you could just go with that one, I think.
Well, okay, so for an example, it's been many years now. It's been 18 years, but when Bob Collins died here, you know, it was a very high-profile funeral in the city, and there were invitations for that because
the
number of people, right, who would want to go exceeded the number of seats, and if you're the family, you want the people there who you want to be there, and you don't want them, you know, being forced outside, so there are invitations.
Right.
I don't think there'll be invitations to mine.
Well, the only way I'm going to get people to show up is if there's a nice ham dinner afterwards. I know that. Bob Collins, was it funeral or memorial service? Were those the same day? Because there was a long line for the public. People queued up down the block to just walk in and pay respects to Bob. Or I just remember the line.
Yeah, and the funeral would have been the next day.
Yeah, right. So we were at that service, and we had seats as employees and friends and family. But I don't know.
As I remember, I had a better seat than you. But
and not to speak about Bob, but I don't know that anybody was per se not invited. It was, there was only so much room to invite people. I mean, that's interesting because I wasn't invited to John McCain's funeral either, and they aren't reporting that I wasn't invited. Of course, if you weren't invited, you weren't invited, but they're reporting that Sarah Palin was not invited. You know, her invitation wasn't rescinded. She simply was not invited. Maybe that's a non-story, but it's being reported as one.
Well, it's a story because people have always wondered about that relationship and, you know, about the, she ran and, you know, it's Sarah Palin is Sarah Palin. And, you know, she's always kind of gossipy news wherever she goes. So I understand why it would be a story.
269 says, Sarah Palin has gone all red hat. Why would the McCains want her present? And 847 says, maybe Tina Fey is going to go. 312, the Palin choice was such a terrible decision. I was voting for McCain until that moment. He admitted the same. 815 says, a non-invitation is that deceased person getting the last word. Well, I think that's what happened, obviously, with Donald Trump. That was the last shot across the bow. Donald Trump can have no retort to that. Is Palin the same thing? I don't know. I don't know. to announce his face, said Sarah wanted to be there for her own publicity-seeking reasons, and there's a good chance that without Sarah there on the ticket, McCain would have won the election. I disagree with both of those. I don't know what Sarah Palin's motivation would have been had she gone except to pay respects. I believe that. She's not running for office right now. And if Lieberman had been on the ticket instead of Palin, would McCain have beaten Barack Obama? I don't think so.
Yeah, it's a good question whether she still was a net plus or net minus. But, I totally think she would be there for attention.
Yeah, it's almost like when you have a wedding and you don't want to invite a high-profile person to overshadow the bride. It's very similar. I mean, everyone should be there for John McCain. And if the story would then be, what is Donald Trump doing? What is Sarah Palin saying? It just, it takes the focus away from the main event.
Well, I don't know, guys. I think you're being pretty hard on Sarah Palin here. I think if Sarah Palin, look, she knows John McCain better than you or I did. She ran with him. She shared the bus with him. They had meals together. If there were some occasion for her to be at his funeral by invitation or because she could make it happen, I guarantee you this is what would have happened. She would have been wearing a black dress and hat. She would have walked in with, is she still with her husband? She would have walked in there and sat down.
No, she wouldn't get a plus one.
She then is quiet, and then she walks out like everybody else with a somber face. Somebody would come up to her and ask her something. She would have said something magnanimous, and that would have been the end of it.
Maybe she would have finally answered what newspapers she reads.
See, you guys are just being mean to Sarah Palin.
I've never seen, this is really uncharacteristic, I think, for Violetta.
Being
Why?
Mean to Sarah Palin?
Yeah, I'm surprised. But
I know.
I'm not being mean to her, but I think she soaks up a lot of sunshine wherever she goes.
All right, but that's on the guy asking the question.
And sometimes, not always.
Okay, but that's an appropriate question, too. Sarah Palin's walking out of John McCain's funeral service. Ms. Palin, whatever the next question is, as long as it's not a stupid question, it's absolutely relevant. She was his running mate. Come on.
But the family doesn't want her there.
Evidently. So then don't go. Then don't show up, Sarah. Be lingering.
I think they didn't end on good terms either, right? I mean, I remember a story where she wanted to give a concession speech before him on election night,
And they didn't let her speak at all.
And so, so just because they worked together for a time doesn't mean that you would want them at your funeral, right?
Fair enough. I mean, right.
You seem to be implying that she should be there because she shared a spotlight with him, not that she was ever close to him or a compadre or things like that. Just
I guess
that they were, in the same spotlight together.
Well, listen, if I'm, I guess it depends on who's making the decision, right? The story I'm reading doesn't say. If it was John McCain's wishes, then fair enough. You need to respect that. If it's Cindy and the family, of course you need to respect that too. But I'm just wondering if it would have been such a bad decision for her to be there. And I don't think it would have been illogical. But if it makes it problematic for the family, then it's their husband and father. So they get to decide. John, that's why I didn't invite you to my wedding. Sorry, I did not want to be upstaged. Says 847. Yeah, I'm sorry. If I go to a wedding, especially if I get on the dance floor, look out. John, it would be very, very interesting to see who is not invited to Trump's funeral. Must be pages of them. 815 says, John, she was lucky that she was not invited. In a way, that's probably true, isn't it? Had Sarah Palin been invited, even if she had comported herself the way I think she would have, it would have been, if she had so much as one awkward look, it would have been blown up into the sorts of things that Violetta's feasting on right now. They would have made a lot more out of it than it was fair or necessary.
Well, even if she said no to going.
Right. And then, right. So if she had an opportunity to go and she says no, well, that seems churlish. So then you have to show up. By the way, I'm not exactly sure I used churlish correctly. Elif, will you look up churlish for us and report back to me on what that word means? John, she was lucky she wasn't invited. Dear John, here's a question I have whenever there's a politician who does this. Do you believe the body of John McCain is really in the casket? They drag these caskets from place to place. I just don't believe the body's in there. I think it went straight to Annapolis to be buried when the family gets there. Have no idea. Never thought about that. All right, we'll take some questions or some calls and some read more texts in a minute. The number is 312-981-7200. This is WGN. I'm just surprised I haven't heard from more people who go, yeah, my uncle and his cousin were, you know, bitter rivals and they never got along. And at the funeral, he said, I absolutely don't want X or Y or Z to come. I mean, that must have happened, especially to our Irish friends out there. It must have happened to a lot of families. I don't know. Somebody said that to me the other day. Have you ever been to an Irish funeral? This is the sort of thing that happens sometimes. I don't know. I don't know.
You mean a grudge? Holding a grudge?
Right. And all the way to the other side. You're dead now. And then you say, and I don't want him showing up at my funeral. And then he's got to make a decision. Well, do I go or not? What am I supposed to do? I guess you don't. If they say don't come, don't come. But I mean, really? You're dead?
But
let him go.
Who's going to stop you?
All right. Right. You have seen this person. They look good. They're happy. They're able to, you know, sit up, take fluids. But then all of a sudden they try and stand up and they go, oh, well, all right. And then they do that slow motion walk before they get some momentum going. That may be you, right? Because your knee's just killing you. Go to the Joint Relief Institute. That's where I went. Boy, they did a great job for me, and I really think they'll do a good job for you. Hey, listen, this is a commercial. They pay for it, and I'm advocating for the Joint Relief Institute. I ain't lying to you. I had a great experience there. I really think you will, too. But if you go to their website, Google Joint Relief Institute, they've got about a four-minute video of just people sitting in the office, testimonials from customer patients of theirs, and the stories are actually heartwarming. A letter carrier who said, for the first time in 4 years, my pain level is a one or a two. A guy who just got back from a long vacation, he said, I was so worried I wouldn't be able to do the hikes and walk on the vacation trip we were on overseas. He said, I was able to walk for hours while I was on vacation. Thank you, Joint Relief Institute. They're in Orland Park. Here's their phone number to call, 708-888-0000. 708, that's Orland Park. 888-THINK-AKK-0000, as in zero pain.
I'm always proud to be introduced by Sarah Palin, but I can't wait to introduce her to Washington. And that's quite a...
His heart never seemed in it.
Quite a response.
That was him in Wisconsin.
Thank you this morning for coming out. And
Yeah. That was John McCain introducing Sarah Palin at one of the rallies or events, and his heart never seemed to be in it, but boy, did they crank it up at those rallies. There were people screaming and cheering, and Sarah was waving when they were on stage, and suddenly the campaign had life it hadn't before. By the way, I used the word churlish a minute ago. Ella, were you able to look that up? What does churlish mean?
Churlish. Rude in a mean, spirited, and surly way. Adjective.
Yeah, I didn't think that she would be churlish, rude, or mean-spirited if she went to the funeral. I think she would have comported herself well. By the way, I'm just reading at CNN.com right now, and they say that it's not just Sarah Palin. So this story has got legs. It's not just Sarah Palin, but his former campaign manager. They're actually noting the people. Three of the most prominent members of his 2008 presidential campaign manager Steve Schmidt, senior advisor Nicole Wallace, and longtime strategist John Weaver were not invited to any of the McCain services.
Yeah, because I watch Nicole Wallace on TV quite a bit. Steve Schmidt's on TV quite a bit, too. Schmidt's one of those Republicans who's renounced his party. You know, he's like switched or something.
Yeah.
Nicole Wallace was a communications director for former President Bush.
CNN writes, in the wake of the 2008 campaign, Schmidt and Wallace were publicly critical of McCain's decision to tap Palin, though Schmidt played a role in it himself. Both cooperated with Mark Halperin and John Heilemann in the 2009 book Game Change. If you haven't read Game Change, go back and read it. It's still relevant. It's just an amazing insight into all of the players of that presidential election. You've got eight of them, right? The husbands and wives of the four candidates, eight of them.
Or watch the HBO movie. Wasn't the movie made of Game Change?
Maybe so. I didn't see that, but I read the book. And my recollection is this. And when having read Game Change, I remember feeling, and I'll just quote me to you, the only person that comes out on top, the only person that looked good in the 2008 presidential election was Michelle Obama. Barack looks, you know, testy and egotistical. John McCain looks disinterested and testy. Sarah Palin, you know, there's not one of them that came out looking terrific, in my recollection, other than Michelle Obama. Lots of calls about this. Let's just take a couple before we break for the news. We'll start with Linda. You're on WGN. Hi, Linda. You're on the air.
Hi, John. I was just going to say, I think if someone should have who they want and who they don't want, I mean, their friends, Democratic senator in Wisconsin, Russ Feingold, who did the Feingold-McCain bill, and if it would have passed, we wouldn't have all these obnoxious PACs in their commercials on TV,
is one of the
pallbearers. It's okay to have a Democrat. You know, it's okay to have a Republican. The man is dead. We honor him. I didn't vote for him, but I honor his service to this country. We should all be doing that.
Well put, Linda. Thanks for the call. I'm going to go from you to Ellen. Jump in there, Ellen. You're on the air.
Hi, John. I love your laugh, and I love Ellis' voice. Now, listen, some special guest news person on one of your shows or somebody's show said exactly, it's not Cindy, it's not his daughter. As soon as McCain got the terminal diagnosis, he called in his aides, and he micromanaged his whole funeral. Who was to come? Who's not going to come? But I would like to know, as an inquiring mind listening to you, is his children's first marriage going to his funeral? Have they reconciled, and are things kosher between those folks now?
I don't know the answer to that. By the way, I don't think you can micromanage your funeral. It's your funeral. It's the only last thing you'll get to do. So if you are managing your funeral, I guess you could micromanage it like, okay, are we going to have shrimp cocktails afterwards? Will it be a rosé or a white wine if the reception afterwards? I guess that would be micromanaging it. But will we accuse somebody of micromanaging their funeral if they say, here's who I want to attend my last service? I don't know. Ellen, thank you for the call. We have to pause. Steve's got the news. That's coming up next. We're just wrapping up our conversation we had about the funeral service and memorial services for John McCain, Sarah Palin, not invited. And somebody was pointing out to us that, how did that go? Sarah Palin was one of the first people to promote Donald Trump's campaign for presidency. She was one of his first supporters. So if everything goes through Donald Trump, that might also explain why.
Well, she jumped on the bandwagon and with the idea that perhaps she would be rewarded for it, and it didn't happen.
Yeah, no kidding, now that you mention it. And really, as much as the spotlight loves Sarah Palin, and Sarah Palin loves the spotlight, we haven't seen or heard much from her since then, right? Remember, Donald Trump came out, and they had a little press conference, and she was all form, thumbs up, and then
not even Donald Trump will hire her.
That's right.
Coming from his last hire, Omarosa.
I know. I was just going to say, think about that. Omarosa gets a job. I don't. Are you kidding me? So that's the latest on that. Just a quick notice here. Did you guys see the there's two stories about tennis attire that I just wanted to address briefly today because we've got a minute here. So at the French Open this year, Serena Williams wore what was described as a black cat suit. It was from her ankles to her wrists, a long sleeve, long-legged, skin-tight, black athletic outfit. She looked terrific in it. She said it helped with the circulation in her legs, the blood flow in her body after, I don't know if this is a sort of a factor after having given birth, but anyway, she said it was good for her blood flow and blood clotting, and this was the healthiest outfit for her to wear. She also looked terrific in it, and she's comfortable in it. But the French Open officials this week said, or was it late last week, said that no longer will Serena be allowed to wear that because it's important to, quote, respect the game. You can't be wearing some sort of black, clingy, I don't know that they use the word sexy, but I'm not sure what their problem with it is. I don't know how it's inappropriate. It's not a white skirt, but for some reason they said it's inappropriate. She can't wear that. And then at the U.S. Open, there is this woman who was playing in between the second and third sets. The heat was so great, they took a 10-minute heat break. You've been following the sort of heat wave on the East Coast? It's just been brutal out there. And there they are playing the U.S. Open. So they take a heat break. And I guess this one woman from France puts on a fresh shirt. She goes out onto the court, and her boyfriend kind of points to her shirt, and he goes, "You've got it on backwards." And she goes, "Oh, my shirt's on backwards." So she kind of goes and stands over by the back wall there and just facing it. She takes it off and then spins it around and puts it back on appropriately. In the process, you were able to see a black and red sports bra. It was, utterly appropriate, but, there was nothing sexy or bad about that. You didn't see much skin. And she shielded sort of herself from everybody's views as well as she can. Anyway, the chair umpire then immediately assesses her a penalty. Not a point, but some sort of warning, like, you can't do that anymore. And then she looked up at the guy and said, she threw her hands up and goes, really? I just spun my shirt around. And the reporting of it, they're quick to note that when it's really hot, the guys get to take their shirts off. I mean, literally, they'll be sitting there at the net in between games where they exchange sides, and the guys can sit there for a minute, take up a bottle of water, and they'll be sitting there without their shirt on. I don't know, not for very long. They put it back on, they go back on the court. But anyway, you see the pictures of the men with their shirt off. Ain't nobody bothering them. She just takes hers off for a second, just enough time to spin it around and then put it back on correctly. And she's warned about that. Well, it's an outrage.
Maybe it's because I'm a straight woman, but I don't find the sports bra to be a very, just wearing a sports bra to be like a sexy or sex appeal look.
Yeah, yeah, right. I mean,
if that makes sense.
And I don't know what their problem could possibly be with that. You know, it's not like she came out flaunting anything, and it's 100 degrees on the court. In fact, to her credit, the player said afterwards, I'll get you her name here in a second, I just highlighted the article, but she said, I thought she spoke she wasn't throwing anybody under the bus, she wasn't real upset about the way she was treated. She said, look, it was really hot out there. Everybody's trying to do their job, and so I'm not real upset about it. But yeah, maybe the umpire made a mistake. He shouldn't have called me on that, but here it is. Here it is. She says, the French player is Alice Cornet, or Cornet, C-O-R-N-E-T. After a 10-minute heat break between the second and third sets, they prepared to start playing. While on the baseline, her boyfriend in the stands points out that the shirt's on backwards. She quickly removed her top, momentarily revealing a black and red sports bra to put it on correctly. Umpire Christian Rask called a code violation, warning for unsportsmanlike conduct. Unsportsmanlike conduct. And she says, I think just the umpire was probably overwhelmed by the situation. You know, we were all very hot outside. Maybe it just didn't make the right decision. Of course, I was surprised when I just changed the T-shirt really quick and they gave me a code violation. I didn't expect it, and I told them it was pretty weird. I kept playing. I was trying to win my match, so I just got over it very fast. And after thinking about it, yeah, I'm convinced that the umpire was making a mistake. But she lost. She's not blaming the umpire. And so we move on. But if you've seen the catsuit that Serena wore, if she wanted to wear that again next year, I would sure support that. You know, for the reason that it's what she wants to wear. It's that's how she wants to play the game. They did, not everybody wears white skirts or white shirts or white shorts anymore. So let her wear what she wants. There is nothing inappropriate about it. When I get to be king, you get to wear what you want. You know, unless, you know, when I'm
flowing,
I'll let you know.
Robe.
It's just going to really, if you wanted to play in a flowing robe and high heels, say you wanted to wear high heel shoes and petticoat, you could wear whatever you want because really you're going to wear the clothes that are in your best interest to help you win the match, right? So it's not about fashion, it's about performance, and we all want to see the best tennis, so wear what helps you play the best tennis. That's an easy one. When I get to be king, I'll be happy to make that decision. That will not be difficult for me. What else do we got here? Guess who else is coming on a little later on? Remember yesterday we had the conversation about the University of Illinois offering free tuition to anybody that makes less than $61,000 a year. If the family is below the median point for income in the state, then the University of Illinois says, if you get accepted, you don't have to pay tuition. You still have to pay room and board, and that'll run you about $15,000, but you'll save about $20,000. It's going to cost the school a couple $10 million, but they've got that. They already do more than that, a lot more than that, in aid and grants anyway. But I just said there's something that bothers me about the family that's making $65,000 a year and then they don't qualify. And I thought, I wonder if they prorate it. Like, if you are over the median, I wonder if they'll give you a small discount based on how close to the median you are. That's what they should do if you're going to try and make education more affordable for everybody. The chancellor for the school is going to join us, Robert Jones. the chancellor at the University of Illinois, Champaign-Urbana, to talk about the program, how it works, and what this means. We'll talk a little bit about that in the 2 o'clock hour. Time now, 1:51 on WGN. Did you read the story in the Tribune the other day about Jason Van Dyke? It was a, I would say, relatively sympathetic look at the man charged with shooting Laquan McDonald. His jury selection starts next week. And then the trial will be underway. He's charged with murdering Laquan McDonald.
And you know today's developments, right?
Say that. I'm looking at that story right now. Okay. Go ahead, Steve. Tell us.
Prosecutors are saying, look, there was a deal not to talk about this trial in the media, and Jason Van Dyke violated that deal, so they want him to either face jail now pending trial or to have an increase in his bond or bail payment.
After he was first arrested, he sat in jail for a while because the family had to find $150,000 in money to get him out. So the judge says, okay, if we raise it now, you'll go back to jail until you raise more money, or maybe we'll just put you in jail, period. That's what the prosecutors are asking the judge to consider, and I guess on Saturday there's going to be a hearing about this. And I don't blame, though, Van Dyke's team for doing that because, all right, go to jail or pay the fine. But in the meantime, maybe you've influenced the jury pool. I mean, really, what's worse, right? You'll go ahead and pay that fine or sit in jail for a while if that helps you get out of jail. And it sure looks bad for Jason Van Dyke, if you ask me. So, yeah, let's roll the dice on that. Worst thing is you go to jail early or for a while, or you have to come up with more money. But I think I would take that risk. What are they going to do? I mean, really, what are you going to do? If you lose this case, you're going to go to jail forever. So, yeah, give it a shot. So they sent over a couple of reporters, and for the first time since Laquan McDonald was killed, he sits down with the Chicago Tribune for about 40 minutes, and he tells him what it's been like for him. He says that he prays every day for Laquan McDonald's family. He says a rosary. And he doesn't think he'll ever sleep well again. And they point out in the article that he's been the recipient of numerous positive awards and citations, and he's also been cited for excessive violence before. But they tell us that never before in his career, even though he's been working some of the tough neighborhoods of Chicago, had Jason Van Dyke used his weapon. He'd never fired his gun. He said, you never want to, and he hadn't. He had no desire to shoot that day. And then when he starts to talk about what happened or what he was thinking before he actually did shoot Laquan McDonald, his attorney goes, don't say that. It was very tightly controlled. There was two attorneys and a media consultant there managing the message. And the judge said, you cannot talk to the media about this stuff. Then he sat down with two Tribune reporters, a media consultant, and a couple attorneys and did exactly that. So the special prosecutor, Joseph McCann's office, is alleging that that violates the judge's decorum order, which prohibits law enforcement employees involved in the case or anyone subpoenaed to talk outside the court. They say among the statements was that Van Dyke viewed himself as a political scapegoat and the victim of the bandwagon of hatred on social media. Well, he absolutely is that. Heck, anybody's the victim of the bandwagon of hatred on social media. That just happens, dude. But is he a political scapegoat? I don't understand that. Political scapegoat? I don't even know how that makes sense.
Well, someone had to pay for the outrage that the community felt.
Yeah, like maybe the guy that pulled the trigger. That doesn't make you a scapegoat. That makes you guilty. Okay, that's how I feel about it. He fears a lengthy prison sentence, even though he'd never fired his gun before in his career. In the filing Thursday, special prosecutors asked that Van Dyke's bond be revoked or increased. Now, police dashboard video shows Van Dyke opening fire within seconds of exiting his squad car. I'm reading from the Tribune in October of 2014 as he walked down the street holding a knife, contradicting reports from police at the scene that McDonald had menaced officers with the weapon. Listen, so we do this Mincing Rascals podcast, and we recorded it just before the show today. So there's Eric Zorn, the columnist from the Tribune, Kristen McQuarrie, who's an editorial writer for the Tribune, Steve and I, and this is the first thing that we talked about today was not this story that they're asking that his bond be revoked, but rather the fact that the Tribune reported it at all. And Eric Zorn was questioning the Tribune's decision to help the Van Dyke team maybe influence potential jurors. He wasn't sure that that was the best choice for the newspaper to aid and abet the Van Dyke side.
I'm sorry, are you talking about me or Eric?
About Eric.
Okay.
And I didn't see it that way at all. I mean, to me, the justice needs to be rendered in the courtroom, and the newspaper gets to tell whatever stories it feels we want to know about.
Right, but the newspaper also knows, and it sounds like, I'm sorry, I didn't read the whole story, but the newspaper sounds like it basically acknowledged that it was being...
Yes.
That this was part of a defense manipulation.
Yes. Yes. Okay. Yes. And so if you know that the only reason that they're offering you Jason Van Dyke, his first interview since Laquan McDonald is shot, and it's the week before they're going to pick jurors, huh, what a coincidence. How lucky for you, Chicago Tribune, that you're going to get that. If you know that you're being played, what do you do with that, right? What's the obligation to the newspaper? And I think... And I don't believe that the answer is necessarily to say, oh, no, we can't take that, but rather to be transparent about it. And the article clearly was.
I mean, take it out of town. What if Paul Manafort was giving the Washington Post an interview days before, weeks before his trial, right?
Yeah, sure.
Looking at it from this distance, we wouldn't see that would be a huge issue.
Well, or we would say, okay, we see it for what it is. This is Manafort trying to save his skin. The Washington Post would have had an obligation to acknowledge that or tell us how the interview went, how managed it was, which the Tribune did. And then, as I think Kristen McQuarrie said in the podcast, you'll be able to hear it later today, believe that the readers are smart enough to see through this, to decide.
Or, for example, every Barbara Walters interview ever.
Right. Well, really, Barbara got people to talk sometimes, but only because they were hanging by a thread or had some reason to get a message out, you know, to sell an album or to tell their side of the story. So I'm with the Tribune for putting it on page one. Now the special prosecutor says maybe Van Dyke should go to jail now.
Thinking big thoughts so you don't have to. Here's John Williams.
Here we go. Mm-mm. We're here We're here weekdays 1 to 3.
Lord have mercy.
A good place for a radio show. Saturdays 10 a.m. till 12 noon on social media. Look for me as WGN King John. I want to be king someday. I think it'll go swell if I get that. Paperwork, I'm told, is tied up at Cook County. We'll talk about this after the 2:30 edition of the news with Steve Bertrand, but just to make quick mention of the fact that the chancellor from the University of Illinois in Champaign is going to join us to talk about that plan to give free tuition to students who qualify and whose family's household income is less than the median in the state, $61,000 a year. And somebody said, I know people who are getting divorced to be below the threshold so that they'll qualify. And I just said, I find that hard to believe. 630 said, hey, John, divorce for financial aid is a real thing. My financial advisor even brought it up when I started my kids' college funds. And the next one says, come on, John, you're naive. Get a divorce and earn $200,000 because you got two kids sounds like a real deal to me. John, I know someone who did that. They got a divorce to get in-state tuition in Iowa. They just filed, but did not actually follow through. The wife, quote-unquote, moved back in with the parents. All four kids got in-state tuition, but she's still living with her husband in Illinois.
I think that's called a crime.
What, tuition or lying on the forms?
Well, I mean, we need a law if there's not a law there, John.
You shouldn't be able to do that. Okay, we'll talk about that after 2:30 and just how the program is working in Illinois. Listen to this story by Morgan Smith in the Tribune from the other day. You may have seen it or the video. Sophia Sanchez had two birthday wishes, a visit from Drake, and a new heart. The 11-year-old Downers Grove resident had her first wish granted August 20th. The rapper paid her a visit about 10 days ago. He walked into her hospital room. Her jaw dropped as she was waiting for a heart transplant. And then Sunday night, Sophia learned that her second wish would be granted. A new heart was ready for her. Tribune learned late Monday that Sophia's surgery was successful. She's recovering at Lurie Children's Hospital after a 9-hour procedure, according to Dr. Carl Backer, the cardiovascular surgeon who performed the surgery. The doctor's on the phone. Doctor, this is John Williams. You're on WGN. Hello.
Hi, John. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you, and how's your patient doing?
Well, she's doing great. I saw her just about 20 minutes ago, and she's taking a nap, but she looks fantastic.
Talk to me a little bit about that. Was it a congenital heart problem that she had? Why did she need a new heart?
She had what we call dilated cardiomyopathy. So for unknown reasons, probably related to adverse reaction to a viral infection, her heart started to dilate up. And even though it was getting larger, it was working less efficiently. So she'd been getting sick over a period of a couple of weeks and maybe even months, and was admitted to an outside hospital with symptoms of shortness of breath, and she was very weak and almost fainting. Got transferred here, and then we made the diagnosis.
Family must have been shocked to hear that their little girl has a failing heart and is going to need a transplant. I mean, is this unusual? Did they have any reason to suspect anything else was wrong with her?
No, she'd been a very active little girl. She was on the cheerleading team in her high school or school. There was no real indication that this was coming. And yes, I would say that they were shocked, but they have been a great family. They've been through a lot, but they've been real troopers with this whole thing.
And the only solution, it's not medicine, there's not something you can do to repair it, it was necessary for a heart transplant, huh?
Yeah, she was actually on medical therapy for about a month, and then actually required, I operated on her about a month ago to put in a left ventricular assist device, which augmented her cardiac output substantially. And her heart definitely did not show any evidence of recovery during the time period that we were treating her with medicines. In fact, it slowly got worse despite the medical therapy.
She's 11 years old. Do you know much about, or are you able to share much about the donor?
No, you know, that's all confidential. The only thing I can tell you is that for any child that receives a heart, the donor must be matched to their, to their size, to their body surface area.
Yeah, right. I wondered about that. So I'll assume that it was a young person as well. And then does a heart or an organ grow larger like our limbs when we all grow?
Yeah, in fact, that's an interesting question, because when we first started doing heart transplants here 30 years ago, that was not completely answered. And we followed a number of our patients with serial assessments of the size of their heart, and it does grow. And it actually grows to accommodate to the patient's size that it's placed in. So if you put a larger heart in a smaller patient, it tends to slow down its growth for a little bit. If you put a smaller heart into a bigger patient, it speeds up, and eventually the two sizes match up. It's a very interesting process.
What's the prognosis for somebody with a heart transplant at the age of 11?
Well, I think it's very good. Our recent statistics have been very good with the long-term survival, particularly as the immunosuppression medications continually improve. You know, every year we seem to get a little bit of an improvement in the way we treat these patients for rejection.
So is it possible that she would live a normal lifespan then with this heart?
Right now I think that's hard to predict, but as I said, with the improvements in immunosuppression, that wouldn't surprise me.
Is she able to have an active life? Can she go back on the cheering squad later on?
Oh, yeah. She's actually been walking around the halls in the hospital already.
Isn't that amazing?
Unbelievable, yeah.
Isn't that amazing? Yeah. It's a 9-hour procedure, so can you just tell me a little bit how that works? What do you do when you do a heart transplant?
The steps, first our anesthesia team puts the patient to sleep, which can be we have a specialized pediatric cardiac anesthesia team, and that can be difficult in a patient that has a marginal cardiac function, and even in a patient like this with a ventricular assist device. But she went to sleep fine. Then we open her chest up, and we hook her up to the heart-lung machine, our external heart-lung machine. We accomplished that without any issues on her. Then the ventricular assist device, which is an implanted device, is removed along with her old heart, the one that's not working. Then we bring the donor heart onto the field, and there's a lot of coordination and communication with the team that traveled to get the heart. We implant the heart. There's five anastomoses that we are, you know, hookups that we have to do. Once we complete all those, we start letting that heart beat on its own, and we come off of the heart-lung machine, stop the heart-lung machine, and the donor heart takes over. Then we close everything up and transport the patient to the Regenstein cardiac care unit.
Simple, simple, huh? No big deal. Anybody can do it.
Right.
Is there a moment in a procedure like that where you all sort of hold your breath to make sure this is going to work? Maybe the moment where you take her off the machine and see if the heart's going to function, or is that pretty much assured that it's all going to go well?
Yeah, I would say there's two emotional moments. The first one is for many years now, you know, I've been doing heart transplants for 30 years. When I bring the new heart and put it into the patient's chest, I say to the new heart, "Welcome to your new home." And that's kind of an emotional moment for everyone.
Yeah.
The next one is when we, so there's a clamp on the patient's aorta that prevents, you know, the blood from the heart-lung machine coming out into the chest. When we finish all the hookups, particularly the aortic anastomosis, which is the main blood vessel coming out of the heart, when we take the clamp off, then we wait to see whether the donor heart is going to beat on its own or not. And that is definitely an emotional moment, because if the donor heart doesn't beat, then that means that there potentially could be something that went wrong with the procurement, or that the donor heart was not as good as we thought it was, or there's always that possibility of acute hyper-rejection where the, you know, the recipient rejects the heart. So we sort of hold our breath at that moment, but once the heart starts beating on its own, then there's a little bit of a sigh of relief. I guess maybe I'd say that three times, and then the third time is when we find out whether or not that donor heart is going to support the patient, and we can come off of the heart-lung machine. So,
if there's an acute rejection, or for some reason the heart doesn't beat, you've already taken the old heart out. Do you have any options then?
Yes. For any patient that undergoes open heart surgery these days, we have machines that can then support the body if the heart doesn't work. So we have, most likely we would use a thing called an ECMO machine, which is like a heart-lung machine.
Yeah.
And that would be able to support the all the organ systems of the body while we waited for the the donor heart to recover, or treated it so that it would work again.
Doctor, do you literally say "Welcome to your new home" when you put the new heart
in? Welcome to your new home.
Why do you say that?
I don't know. It just feels like something. It's an emotional moment for everyone, and that heart came from another child that died, usually under, you know, not great circumstances, and I just want to welcome that heart to its new home.
If the donor's family wanted to reveal themselves, would then the parents of that first child be able to meet this little girl? That happens sometimes, right?
Yeah, there's a pretty formal policy within United Network of Organ Sharing where the donor family would have to, and they receive information on how to do this. They would contact the UNOS, and then UNOS would then contact the recipient family and ask them if they wanted to meet the donor family. If both parties agree, they would not be communicating directly with each other, but indirectly through the UNOS, then there are ways that they can arrange for those two groups to meet.
That's a fascinating and tragic, but also heartwarming in a way, story. I think I've seen the instances where now the family of the donor puts their hand on the chest of the recipient and feels their child or loved one there, and it's a very healing kind of thing for them in a way, isn't it?
Absolutely. Yep. It shows the importance of donor awareness.
Sophia Sanchez was an 11-year-old girl. She still is, from Downers Grove. The resident had two wishes. She said, someday I want to meet Drake, like all 11-year-olds, and their mothers, for that matter. And then she needed a new heart, and both of those have been arranged. Did you get to meet Drake, by the way, doctor?
I did not meet Drake. I was actually operating when he was here, but his visit spread through the hospital like wildfire. We knew when he was getting on the elevator, and we knew when he was visiting Sophie. Actually, my nurse, Alyssa, was actually just happened to be on the elevator bringing some of our OR supplies upstairs, and she got on the same elevator with Drake.
You know, you thought you were a rock star. You know, I'm a pediatric cardiac heart surgeon guy. That's a big deal. But you're not Drake now, are you, doctor?
No. Well, my children let me know that they were much more impressed with the fact that Drake came to visit my patient than that I had done a heart transplant on the patient.
Our texts include these. John, how long can a donor heart be kept on ice? How much time do you have after the donor heart becomes available?
So once the donor heart is, actually removed from the donor, we like to have it implanted in the recipient within about 4 hours. So that's why, again, why there's a lot of communication and coordination. And
how many people are involved in that procedure? I mean, from both ends, how many people are involved in making this transplant happen?
I would say in the range of 25 to 30 people.
How many people are in the operating room at one time?
Probably 8 or 9.
If it's a 9-hour procedure, are you awake and doing the surgery the whole time? And is the stamina of the doctor an issue for something like that? The focus and the physical?
Yeah. Yep, it is. Yep.
You got to be in good shape, I guess, to do that. I mean, you can't just sit on the sidelines for a quarter. You've got to be in the game the whole time.
Correct.
John, whether this doctor believes in God or not, please tell him regular folks thank God for people like him. And this texter says, please give Dr. Bracker our best. He did my son's Liam's transplant 12 years ago, and he's doing great. Am I reading that correctly? L-I-A-M-S? What's a Liam's transplant?
Liam. Liam is his first name.
Ah, I see. My son Liam's transplant. Wow. A heart transplant then 12 years ago, and the kid's doing great. When the kids are on the anti-rejection medication, or adults for that matter, it seems like in the past we've seen pictures or videos of these people, and they get kind of puffy. Is that still the case? Would I recognize somebody to look differently after they're on the anti-rejection medication?
The puffiness is much less now, because we used to our immunosuppression regimen used to be mostly based on the use of steroids, and now we use steroids at the very beginning, but they're tapered off quite quickly, sometimes even in the first 4 to 6 weeks after the operation.
Hey, John,
steroids are what made people puffy.
Right. So, I mean, I guess that's a small consideration, but you want to have as normal a life as possible. It's nice to hear that, too. This texter says, King John, my youngest son died in his sleep, May of 2013, from myocarditis. Myocarditis is typically caused by a virus, which this doctor mentioned, adverse reactions to a virus. Had he lived, he would have needed a heart transplant. So I guess this is not unheard of, this condition. What's happened here, huh?
No, it's, and I would say for us, we're the only center in Illinois that does heart transplants. We see our fair share of this. I mean, we did 27 heart transplants last year.
Oh, my.
So, and a couple of those were cardiomyopathies, so even though it's uncommon in the general population, we're pretty familiar with these patients here at this hospital.
We were talking about medical expenses on the show about this time yesterday, unrelated to your visit with us. How does a family afford something like this, and how much does something like this cost?
Well, fortunately, families, it's either covered by insurance, or families that don't have insurance, it's covered by the state of Illinois. In almost all cases, and the expense is mostly related to the length of the hospital stay.
Right.
So the longer they're in the hospital, Sophie was in the hospital a month before her ventricular assist device, and then another month. But I will say that now that she has a well-functioning donor heart, she's probably going to get out of here pretty soon, which will I mean, not that that's a main focus, but that will cut down on the expenses to get her well enough to be able to go home and leave the hospital.
Well, the family's got to live. I'm reading from a friend of a friend who said at Dorhofer Park in Downers Grove from 6 to 8 o'clock, they're having a fundraiser for the family tonight. Sophie is a Panther cheerleader. You mentioned that. And the organization is throwing a fundraiser to raise money for her family and whatever bills that they accrue that they can't pay. So they're selling pizza and baked goods in Downers Grove at, am I saying it right, D-O-E-R-H-O-E-F-E-R, Dorhofer Park in Downers Grove. They're having a sale from 6 to 8 o'clock tonight, so let's all turn out for that. Doctor, anything else you'd like to pass along? You've been very generous with your time. I know you're busy here. This is fascinating and fantastic stuff.
I just want everybody out there to know we have a whole team of people that do these transplants. You touched on the number of people that were in the room, but we have our anesthesia team, our nursing team, our cardiology team, the respiratory therapists, pharmacy, blood bank, the nurses in the intensive care unit, post-op. I mean, there's a massive number of people at the hospital that contribute to the successful outcome of a transplant like this.
Well, it's nice of you to mention that. I know we won't take the time to give all of the names. You probably could hear, but is there a moment afterwards that you all must just glow feeling so good about what you're able to do?
Well, I think for me, so far the happiest moment was when I went upstairs yesterday after finishing an open heart case, and Sophie was walking the halls with a little entourage of nurses. That was unbelievable.
It is amazing.
Yeah.
And by the way, if you haven't seen the video of this little girl, every child deserves a full, rich life and another heart if theirs is failing them. So the fact that this girl is just delightful and spunky and has such a warm personality, I mean, she's a cheerleader, this little girl, doesn't mean that the other kid who isn't doesn't deserve everything that this kid got. But oh my God, is this girl delightful. She's just pops on TV, and if you ever wanted to root for somebody, it would be very easy to root for Sophia, that's for sure.
I guess the other thing, I'd like to thank Drake for coming here to the hospital. I mean, it was a very uplifting thing for her, and I think it put her into a great frame of mind to go into the transplant, so
yeah.
Shout out to Drake for coming here.
Listen to that. Shout out to Drake. Hey, Drake, listen, if you want to help the attitude at WGN Radio, feel free to swing by our studios. We'd love to see you. Doctor, congratulations. Do well, okay?
All right, thanks. Nice to talk to you, John.
Dr. Carl Backer joining us. And I need you, and I'm down for you always, KB. Do you love me? Are you riding? Say you never ever leave from beside me. 2:30 on WGN. Yesterday we were talking about that plan at University of Illinois. Free tuition for half of the state. We're going to talk with the chancellor about that after the news. Wasn't it strange to hear people say that they're hearing stories about people changing their marital status so they can qualify for various programs to go to college?
Well, especially this one, because it's not up and running yet, right?
Well, the one that they're offering at the University of Illinois is for the 2019 semester. But then somebody else said, hey, no, we know a couple that got divorced so that they could then, I don't know, lie about something on a form and then qualify for in-state tuition in Iowa.
Like the woman divorced the husband and she said she moved back with her parents in Iowa.
Yeah, right, exactly.
But she never did.
Yeah, but I mean, I've heard, now that I think about it, a colleague of mine once said that her husband said, hey, it wasn't for tuition's sake. It was just for income tax purposes. He said, honey, if we file married, we're going to pay more in taxes than if we file separately as divorced people.
Mm-hmm.
We'll still live together. We don't even have to tell the kids. But if we get a divorce, we'll save some money.
Did they do it?
They did not. He was up for it. She was not.
As is so often the case.
With saving money or divorces?
Exactly. So the story we talked about yesterday was this plan that we read about in the paper. The University of Illinois at Champaign-Urbana says that if you are below the median income for a household, $61,000, you would qualify for, if you get into the school, free tuition. Not room and board, but how about them apples? At least that's my understanding. Chancellor Robert Jones from the University of Illinois at Champaign-Urbana is on the phone. Chancellor, this is John Williams. You're on WGN. Thanks for joining us. How are you?
I'm fine, John. It's my pleasure to be with you this afternoon.
You've heard us just crosstalk here for a minute. Any observations?
Yes, I did.
Any observations about what you just heard there, Chancellor?
No, I'm not going to touch most of that, so I appreciate it.
Right. Whatever those other people are doing, that's not your problem. But tell me about this, tell me about this program that U of I has.
Well, this is a program that we certainly hope will demonstrate our dedication and continued dedication to access and affordability to Illinois residents, particularly for folks from low to middle income. It's something that's been at the core of the university for a number of years, but we think fundamentally that this new initiative is going to address a problem that we know to be true, that far too many of our young people who have worked hard, you know, from pre-K to 12th grade to be college ready, to prepare themselves for an Illinois education, don't bother with applying because of sticker shock. You know, our tuition is known throughout the state, and so people are pretty much frightened away from going through the process of applying when it becomes clear that they may not or will not be able to afford to accept the offer, even if we admit them. So this is going to take the question of affordability off the table for this particular cohort of potential students, because I think the notion of free tuition and campus fees is pretty clear, and that's exactly what we mean.
Would that be for anybody that qualifies? That is, say our family makes $50,000 a year, below $61,000, and the student gets admitted, and therefore they'd qualify for the program. But what if they have a rich uncle? Or what if, in fact, they've saved and they have $100,000 in an account for the child's college education? Are you basing it just on the income, or how do you determine who does and doesn't qualify?
It's going to be based on the standard process that we utilize, everybody uses across the country, called the FAFSA,
sure,
which pretty much gives you an indication of the financial status of the family, and that it will be the basis on which we will make the decision. We chose the $61,000 because that is the median income, family income for the state of Illinois.
But it's possible then, if I may, Chancellor, that some people,
sure,
who make less than $61,000 wouldn't qualify because on the FAFSA they can demonstrate other resources, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. That would be a possibility.
Yeah.
Yes.
And
but
then
it's also possible if you make slightly more than $61,000, you know, there are other mitigating circumstances that might provide an opportunity for those students to be admissible as well. And we do have built into this kind of an acceleration piece so that if a family's income increases during the time the student is enrolled, there's a way to make sure they're not just kicked out of the program because of a modest increase in income.
Okay. But, you know, to be honest with you, Chancellor, I'm feeling bad for the family that makes $68,500 a year. They just missed the window. Are they out of luck?
If they don't meet the qualification standards that we're setting this program, I'm afraid so. But the other side of the story is that we have been working hard and will continue to make sure that students from all social economics stratus of this state do have some kind of access. So we'll continue to support students that fall outside of this guideline, same way that we've done in the past, you know, by using our resources to try to minimize as much as we can the amount of debt that the students will leave here with. It won't take it down to zero or as much as we would like to. But I would like to say that whole middle income category, I would say from 60 maybe up to 120, 25 or so, middle income is not what it used to be.
No.
And so we recognize that. And if you have a couple of 2 to 3 kids in school, the way a number of our citizens do, it becomes a real challenge. And so we have already in place some mechanisms to try to address that to the extent that we can, and we will continue to make those investments as well. And now with the new AIM High program, it provides another avenue for us to address that with this merit-based program. So So we've been doing that for quite some time. And for us, that I can't emphasize enough, this is actually about making sure the university is affordable and accessible. I'm not sure if you guys read Money Magazine or not, but we were very pleased that the 50 best colleges in the U.S. was published in the magazine about a week or so ago. And it really profiled the 50 best schools that deliver a superior education at an affordable price, enabling its graduates to avoid heavy debt and then succeed in the workplace. And we're very pleased, number one, that the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign is number 25 on that list. I think at the top of the list was Princeton University. Mm-hmm. We're the only institution in the state that made that list in terms of the top.
You know, I think what the knock on you guys is, not that it's not a great value. In fact, what's the tuition? It's about $20,000, right? That's a lot. But
no, the tuition is, depending upon program, it's more like $12,000 to $15,000, just the tuition piece.
I understand
that. But when you add fees and books and other cost of living, it gets to be very expensive. Right. And unfortunately, that's the number that people go to.
Well, but the point I was trying to make was that, $12,000 or $15,000, say. I think the problem with the University of Illinois is not the cost, it's that you can't get in. It's access to that school. Do you have anything to say about that?
No, I guess I would have to differ with you. The cost for many people is the access denial point.
Yeah.
Yes, the university, as hopefully you would expect to be, by being the world-class institution that it is very, very competitive. We do have very high demand for access to the university. Yes, we have nearly 39,000 or more applications each year. But at the same time, if we have a situation where a certain segment of our population in the state is effectively denied access because of the optics around the affordability piece, that's the piece we're trying to address. And those students still have to be qualified. They still have to be admitted before they can get access to this free tuition program.
Yeah, understood.
So it really is about, access to what? Yes, the university is expensive, but one of the things we know, if you look at this in terms of the return on investment, and that's why we made this number 25 on this top 50 list, because we know firsthand our students graduate from this university with about $5,000 less in debt than the national average.
You know, when I get to be King Chancellor, Robert Jones is on the phone line from the University of Illinois at Champaign. When I get to be King, college education, at least through your sophomore year, will be free. I think if you can get into a state university, be it Joliet Junior College or the University of Illinois, I think we should provide free college education.
Well, when you get to be king and you're able to orchestrate that, you have to figure out a different financial model to allow universities to be able to deliver education with that kind of structure as well. But since you're king, you can make anything happen, right?
Yeah, I haven't done all the hard work yet. I'm just telling you, I'm just telling you what I want. By the way,
I understand.
Tamara is online, too, and she had a question, one of our listeners. Tamara, you're on WGN. Go ahead.
Hello. You had brought up the issue of accessibility, and especially for our Illinois high school students that are unable to be accepted. It's been reported, I believe in the Chicago Tribune, that over a quarter of undergraduates at the University of Illinois are indeed not just out-of-state students, but foreign students. So it seems to me that our Illinois students should have first choice at those positions and not foreign-born students. Wouldn't that make a great deal of sense and be fairer to the taxpayers and students here in Illinois?
Chancellor, what's your response to that?
My response is that, as a public university and to make sure that we're providing opportunities for students to get a world-class education that allows them to go off and be good citizens, not only of their state, but good citizens of the country and able to work effectively in a global environment, we believe very strongly in making sure that we have an appropriate mix of residential as well as non-residential students, students from other parts of the country, as well as international students. And I think one of the things that's perhaps lost on far too many of our citizens in this state is that we educate more Illinois students than any other institution in the state. And if you look at our peer group, other Big Ten and other aspirational peers, we have a larger in resident, state resident population than anyone else in the Big Ten and others in our peer group. So we, and actually that has increased. If you look at our incoming class, it has gone from 73% or 72% residential Illinois students to the class we just welcomed with over 7,600 students, 75% of those are Illinois residents.
And so the percentage, and the percentage at other Big Ten schools is lower than that?
Oh, significantly lower. It will range anywhere from the high 40s to the closest one to us in the Big Ten is Michigan State with about 73%.
I am out of time. I really appreciate the call tomorrow. I think that's an issue that a lot of people think and talk about. And Chancellor, I'm glad you addressed that. And I wish you guys a lot of luck with this program. I hope people find out about it and that you reach the kids that wouldn't otherwise go to the U of I.
Well, we certainly thank you for the opportunity to talk about this. We do think it's a big deal. We think it's transformative and is part of our commitment to further expand opportunities for our students of the state to receive a world-class education at an affordable price.
Robert Jones from the University of Illinois. Lots of texts, and some of you ain't loving this. John, this isn't free. I scrimped and saved to put my kid through the U of I, and now I get to pay for someone else? 630 says, our bankrupt state can't afford this. And 773 said, hey, John, I think the U of I has never put Illinois residents ahead of other applicants. I got four kids. It's cheaper to send them to private out-of-state colleges than to Illinois. We're going to talk more about this in the 2 o'clock hour tomorrow.